Chapter 9. Slayers of Kings. Spear of Many Blades. The Truth of Knives. Battle Barge War Oath. Supra Solar Gulf. The hollow images of Kyber and Sotanul collapsed into static and then darkness. The psychic projection of Araman lingered. The chief librarian of the Thousand Suns looked at Abaddon for a moment, then spoke in thought. "Farewell," he said. And then his image was gone, leaving a ghost of psychic frost on the air. "May all be done as it is willed." Abaddon looked unblinking into the space vacated by the two subfleet commanders. Above and behind him, the council chamber rose and spread out, the empty air silent to its shadow-draped walls.
"May all be done," said Abaddon into the empty dark.
Such was the intent of what they did, that the ultimate ends of each part of the attack were known only to the most senior commanders. Of that cadre, only some were aware of the interlocking purposes of their actions, and even then, only a few, a very few, knew the inner knots of the War Master's design. No one else could know, even amongst the highest ranks of the Legion, or its closest allies. So the last gathering of those commanders before they took to their own paths had taken place in the empty dark, without aides or companions. Abaddon stood still at the centre of the room for a moment, his eyes reaching into the dark, but not seeing it. Torchlight danced in the distance. Blood hazed his sight.
"This is him," came a voice, low but clear and strong.
Abaddon looked up and felt the chains tighten around his neck. Two shadows loomed above him, both held torches of bright flame.
"He looks barely alive." "We would not have got him if he hadn't been that way. He went through 30 of the Deep Warren gangs before we found him. That was after the rest of his followers had fallen. He was making for a tunnel when we reached him."
"He will survive those wounds."
"If he doesn't, then do we want him?"
A low grunt of acknowledgement, and then one of the looming shadows came forwards and squatted down. The light of the torch it carried pulled streaks of orange and red across grey-white armour. Dark eyes looked at Abaddon from a face of scar tissue and jagged tattoos.
"You see us, don't you, boy?" said the face.
Abaddon did not reply. He had been in the deeps, leading a raid against the Warren holdings of the Headtakers. There had been an ambush. They had been waiting, 3 clans worth at least, come to take the head of the exiled prince. Hundreds of gang killers pouring from tunnels, the boom of frag mines detonating, hard rounds buzzing through the air. They had killed half of his oath siblings with the first blasts. It was butchery and cowardice. But he had come out of the smoke and dust and hit the first ambusher he had seen with a backhanded blow that had split the man's head along the hinge of his jaw to the back of his skull.
"You know who we are?" asked the face, its gaze unflinching.
Abaddon met it and nodded.
"You are the Takers of the Dead," he said.
The face laughed.
"That we are, boy. That we are."
The figure held up a coin in armoured fingers. The silver disc's face was mirror-polished.
"I have a coin for your life."
Abaddon did not move, but held his face and gaze still. There was pain in his side. He could taste blood. He was going to die, but he was not going to give these creatures that looked like men the trophy of victory. If they had come for his life and soul, then they would have to rip it out of him. The Takers of the Dead had always been there. They lived in the night and stars that circled through Chthonia's skies. They watched, judged, and took the worthy up to the dark to become like them. Some thought them just a story, but whole clans had vanished during the gang wars of recent years and were never seen again. The Takers were real.
"We have been looking for you," said the face. "For the exiled prince who killed his father rather than murder his oath companions and become a man."
Abaddon remained silent. The other figure, still half out of sight, shifted and gave a bark of laughter.
"You won't get anything from him, Siracule. Look at him. He's not a talker. There's too much anger looking for a way out. That's why he is here. That's why he nearly died in those tunnels and got everyone who believed in him killed. He may be a killer, but he is filled with so much fire that he will burn everything he touches.
The second figure stepped into Abaddon's blurred sight. This one wore the same grey-white armour as the first, and held a comb-topped helm under his left arm. Abaddon's eye caught the sign of a crescent moon marked on the helm above the right eye. The man's skin was the black of polished cinderwood. A close-cropped mohawk of hair ran across his scalp. Wide silver-grey eyes glittered above a smile.
That's right, isn't it? You will look upon us and not say a word, even if we reach into you with knives and cut out your soul.
The first figure, one called Cyricule, stood.
Is my brother right, boy? Asked Cyricule. Or do you have more than anger flowing in your veins, Abaddon?
He felt his face twitch at the sound of his name, and his eyes flicked between the pair, looking down at him.
Yes, we know your name, said the figure with grey eyes. We know who you are and what you have done. We know that you killed almost all the clan of your birth, and that those that remain have hunted you ever since. We know that you killed everyone sent against you, and then found who sent them, and did to them what they failed to have done to you. We know all this. We know you are a killer and a survivor, Abaddon, son of Tarkaradon. What we don't know is if you have the strength to be more.
I don't.
Abaddon forced the words out through broken teeth and pain. At some point in the fight, after the ambush, something had shattered half the bones of his face.
I don't want to be a king.
Laughter boomed out again.
That is something you will never be, Abaddon, said the warrior with grey eyes. Either you will die here, or you will become one of us. We are the slayers of kings, and the killers of tyrants. We are brothers in war and blood. We live for each other and die for the future we make, and that is all we will ever be. Can you be that, Abaddon?
He looked up at them. The pain was trying to pull him down into its grasp. He sucked a breath, heard the chains clink. In his mind he saw the cave of becoming again. His father falling from his bloody hand, him turning fast but too slow as one of the guards yanked back Kaz's head and sawed a knife across his blood sibling's throat.
Is what you say true?
Abaddon asked, pulling the words from the pit of his pain.
Do you swear that it is true?
Cyricule glanced at his companion and then nodded.
It is true, boy, by the oath I took on this moment. It is true.
Abaddon tried to rise, but the chains held him.
I am,
he said, hearing his voice rasp.
Then I am yours.
They did not move. He could feel them watching him, weighing him in their eyes.
Break the chains, said the grey-eyed warrior.
Cyricule stepped forwards and took hold of the links of Abaddon's bonds and broke them as though they were rotten rope. Cyricule and the grey-eyed warrior watched him. Abaddon drew a breath and then pushed himself upright, inch by agonized inch, until he stood, bloody, his face a broken mess. His left arm hung by his side, broken, the hand hanging by a strand of skin and sinew. Pain shook through him. The grey-eyed warrior exchanged a look with Cyricule and then nodded.
I am Hastur Sejanus. There is a long road ahead of you, Abaddon, and much of it will be marked with greater pain and loss than you have ever known. There is no reward at the end, except to be one of us, to be a brother of warriors and wolves. If that is not enough, then it is better to never begin.
Abaddon swayed, refusing to let himself prove weaker than his wounds in front of these warriors.
It will not be enough, he said. It will be everything.
Cyricule laughed.
I like him. He's going to be trouble.
Abaddon watched the dark replace the past, then turned and walked away. Freighter ship Antius, Trans-Saturnian Gulf. Mercedes awoke with a start.
No,
she gasped, with a breath that had been drawn in a dream of a wolf turning to smile at her with bloody teeth. The staterooms were quiet around her, the thrum of the ship a low murmur swallowed by tapestries and cushions. She breathed hard for a moment, looking around at the shadows folded over the furniture by the single glow globe mounted on a turned bronze stand. The cushions of the couch beneath her were damp, and her clothes clung to her skin.
"Bad dreams?" asked Nihlus.
The navigator sat in an upholstered chair across the room, his long legs drawn up under him onto the seat, so that he looked like an old statue of a mystic that she had once seen in a conservatory collection. He had found some clothes to replace his prison overalls. Loose black and red fabric now hung from his spider-thin frame. He had a blanket half wrapped around him, but he did not look like he had been sleeping.
"The merchant's sour-faced bodyguard left you some clothes," he said,
nodding to a neat pile of fabric on a small table.
"I don't think she likes you much."
Mercedes pushed herself up, scratching sleep from her eyes. There was a metallic taste in her mouth, like copper or iron.
"Where are we?"
she asked.
"Somewhere in the gulf between Uranus and the orbit of Saturn," he said, and shrugged. "At least that is what I would guess. You've been asleep for a while. But this is going to take days, even if this bucket of bolts and rust can make it. It's really just an orbital hauler. I doubt it's even done a full run from core to system edge."
He smiled and shook his head.
"We may all die yet."
Mercedes did not answer, but stood up and went to the pile of clothes. The Antaeus had broken free of the cascade around Oberon and powered outwards towards Uranus's outer orbits and the gulf beyond. No one had challenged or tried to intercept them, but they were just another panicked small ship amongst many more. No reply had come from the signal they had sent either, but she had expected none. For all her confidence in front of Vec, it was an act of desperation, not certainty. A stone thrown into a pool in the hope that someone would see the ripples. She lifted the folded clothes, loose, grey and red.
"She said she would be back for you," said Nihlus. "The bodyguard, that is. I think she wants to talk."
He stood, unwinding his limbs from the blanket, rolling his head on his neck and then moving towards one of the hatches that led to a different part of the staterooms.
"I'll leave you to your privacy," he said,
and went out of sight. She put the clothes on, the soft, clean fabric strange on her skin. The main doors to the staterooms opened. The tall silhouette of Axinia, the bodyguard, stood framed by the amber glow of lumen strips. Pale eyes met Mercedes' gaze for a second. Something in the cold intensity of that stare reminded her of something, a fragment of an image lost in the cracks of the past. Axinia jerked her head and turned back to the corridor.
"Follow,"
she said. Mercedes complied. They walked in silence for long minutes, descending ladders and stairs into spaces that smelled of raw oil and hot metal.
"Where are we going?"
asked Mercedes. Axinia did not answer, but keyed a control on a heavy door crossed with chevrons. The door released with a hiss and thump of pneumatics. The smell of human sweat and breath washed out. Axinia moved aside and gestured for Mercedes to go through. The light beyond was a different hue, dim but cold, like a stab light running on low power. They were standing in the corner of a cargo hold, its roof arched up to a flattened apex some 10 meters above her head. It was small compared to the vast holds on a macro transporter or warship, but somehow it felt even smaller to Mercedes as she looked at those who waited there. A loose wall of people faced her, staring eyes set in exhausted faces. She saw every age amongst the faces, children peeking out at her from between parents' legs, the old, the young, all staring with a little curiosity and a lot of fear. They wore fabric of every kind and quality, the vulcanized rubber and oil-smeared suits of void dock luggers, jackets of velvet dotted with brass buttons, smocks of service stenciled drab, all grubby and stained with days of wear. None of the faces moved. Most eyes barely seemed to blink. She heard sounds coming from the other side of the crowd and realized that there must be people that she could not see filling the hold space. Ribbons of cooking smoke coiled into the air. She coughed as the smell of excrement and urine touched the back of her throat.
"Who are you?"
asked a clear voice from down near the floor. Mercedes looked down and saw two brown eyes looking up at her from beneath a matted mass of ash-white curls. Mercedes glanced up at the adults standing next to the child, but they did not move or speak. They and all those others that she could see were looking at Axinia, who had come to stand just behind her. She looked back at the child and bent down, so that she was level with that big brown gaze.
"I..."
began Mercedes, and stopped, not sure what to say.
"I am called Mercedes. I used to tell stories."
"What kind of stories?"
asked the child.
"True ones."
"I like the stories that my grandfather tells. They aren't true, though. They have ghosts and ships of treasure in them, and the kings and queens of the sun and the night of the moon. The ones about the night are the best. She rides across the stars, you know, and she can never speak. Not ever. And she has a sword that you can't see, and she doesn't dream, because she had to give her dreams to the sun to keep while she went to find the creatures that live in the night."
Mercedes found herself smiling.
"I like stories like that too."
The child nodded, face serious.
"My grandfather will tell me a story when we get back to Cordelia. That's our home. We had to leave, but we will go back. But I have to tell the stories to myself until then."
A hand reached down and took the child by the shoulder and tugged her back. Mercedes looked up into the face of a hard-eyed man with a Uranus indentured service tattoo circling his cheek.
"Come on, Sibby," he said, then looked at Mercedes. "You bring any food down here with your nice words and clean clothes?"
Mercedes straightened, suddenly aware that the line of people had moved almost imperceptibly forwards. There was anger in their eyes now.
"No,"
she began.
"No, I'm sorry. I didn't know I..."
"What's happening?"
came a call from further back.
"I..."
Mercedes began.
"Where are we going?"
The line was a crowd now, sliding closer, so that she could smell the sweat and breath and feel the static charge of fear.
"Why are you here?"
came a growl, and a hand reached for her. Axinia stepped forwards and batted the hand down. The crowd shrank back from the bodyguard.
"Go,"
said Axinia, pushing Mercedes towards the door they had entered through. The crowd did not follow them, but Mercedes thought she could feel their stares, even after the chevron-crossed metal closed. She stood for a second in the passage. Axinia moved to walk past her.
"I understand,"
she said to the bodyguard.
"Do you?"
said Axinia, stopping and looking at Mercedes.
"There are 6 holds on board, all of them just like that. How much food do you think a ship like this has in its stores? How long do you think it will last when split between hundreds of mouths? How long do you think until they are not happy to stay where they are? How long until they try to get out? What does your understanding say about what happens then?"
"I'm sorry, but I didn't cause this."
"No, you didn't. But you stopped it getting any better. If we could have docked, we could have got some of those people off, and we could have got supplies. There are people hunting us now. People looking for you. People who will shell fleeing ships on their own side to get to you. So now we all have to run. That little one you were talking to? What do you think happens to her if the people hunting you find us? Have you ever seen what that kind of violence is like?"
"Yes,"
said Mercedes, holding the bodyguard's cold gaze. After a long moment, Axinia nodded.
"Perhaps you really have. But it makes no difference. I am bound to protect my master and his family. That's it. This ship and the people on it are not mine to shield. That can be no other way."
She took a step closer. And now she was so close that Mercedes could feel the thread of the other woman's breath. It smelled like metal.
"But you... you have pulled the fates of everyone on this ship and made them yours. I do not know, and I don't care, why the master believes you, but I want you to know that whatever happens to him and these people won't be his fault. It will be yours, teller of stories. It will be yours."
Axinia turned and walked away down the dim passage.
"Go back to your quarters,"
she called back at Mercedes without looking around.
"He will want to talk to you soon."
Mercedes Oloton stood still for a second and then followed. Battle Barge War Oath, Supra Solar Gulf. The armada split as it plunged towards the sun. Battle groups began to pull onto separate paths. First the smallest, which rode at the edge, then the larger ships, one layer of formation at a time, peeling apart like a knot of rope unwinding into threads. Far out, circling the dividing fleet, the White Scars saw the formation of enemy ships begin to change. They made kills then, driving in to pick off smaller frigates and gunboats as they broke from the safety of the herd. But the reformation of the armada went on, recasting the single fleet as many without its slowing down. The White Scars plunged back in, but as they struck, a flock of hundreds of smaller ships broke from the divided armada. They were the fastest of the invaders' ships, crewed by rogue traders and renegade privateers. They had flocked to Horus's call, and been given this task in exchange for promises of wealth and power. They were the crows of war that had followed the Great Crusade out to the edge of the dark, and now came back to feast on the corpses of their masters. They scattered outwards from the armada, spiralling out to meet the Falcon fleets. Hundreds of small battles spread across the dark, tumbling in the wake of the main mass of the armada. And the shape of the armada continued to change. With the skin of smaller craft gone, the main force was revealed. Many vessels bore the livery of the Sons of Horus, blooded war crones like the Last Light, the Oath of Moment, and the Spear Wolf. The legionaries on board were veterans, born in the time before the betrayal, breakers of their oaths to the Emperor and keepers of their bonds to their Primarch. Beside them rode vessels of such different lines that they seemed less a fleet and more a collection of creations formed of mankind's ingenuity in shipcraft, fused with insanity. Galleons of black metal, their skins dotted with chrome pyramids, sleek needles of serrated bronze 5 kilometres long, slabs of red stone the size of mountain ranges, hoisted into space and made into city ships, their insides filled with ever-turning machines. These were the craft of the disciples of Kelbor Hal and his new Mechanicum. No two were alike, their size and shape reflections of the Magi who commanded them. One by one, the Legion and Mechanicum ships began to separate, pulling into twin spear blades. For a few hours, the two formations continued to descend towards the disk of the solar system together, leaving the Falcon fleets and the privateer carrion feeders behind to spin in battle. Hour by hour, the two fleets moved further and further apart, until each of them could see the light of the other's engines only as a single dot of starlight. Abaddon watched it all on a display enhanced by scan data, not moving from his place as the hours passed. Around him, the business of the War Oath's bridge went on in near silence. It was an act of will for him to remain still, his mind following all the details while the sound of his heartbeats filled his ears, restless and unsettled. But there he remained, watching time and distance pass. There would be battle and bloodshed before victory, but that all rested on these moments. From here, each part of the armada would follow its own path to its own target and its own battles. The White Scars would have seen this first division, and they would track both blades of the divided spear. But not yet. That could not happen yet. There was one more moment of vulnerability and secrecy still to come, one more sliver to be broken off this spear blade. Abaddon felt the prickle across the skin of his back. His muscles twitched, his armour amplifying the tiny movement with a buzz of servos. He kept his eyes on the display, but bared his teeth.
"I did not call you to my presence, priest," he said, "and I have no use for your counsel."
Zardu Leak halted at his side. The incense reek of the demon priest filled the air.
"I go where I am needed, not where I am called."
"You are part of the Comet Strike Force. That is where you need to be. The ships of the 15th and your legion are ready to depart."
"But I am not to depart," said Leak.
Abaddon looked back at him, But the priest was already stepping close, his eyes on the display, his staff tapping the stone floor.
I remain here, with you.
You will go to join the spear thrust to the comet, said Abaddon. That is my will.
But it is not the will of the gods.
I do not care.
Layak was silent for a moment.
These hands were once those of an iconoclast, he said at last, holding up a fist. Did you know that? The warrior who became me burned gods and lived to send the devout and the deluded to the flames.
Your conversation is of no interest to me, said Abaddon.
I was not a convert, said Layak. The man whose face lies beneath this mask was taken, broken, and remade. My faith is sacred because it is a lie, and all lies are music to the ears of the pantheon. Piety like that is false, a creation, but it is pure. You live for Horus, for your legion, for your brothers. That is your truth. Mine is that I am nothing. I am a son who left his father. I am a brother who made those brothers his slaves.
Layak nodded to the still and silent figures of the blade slaves standing 8 paces away.
I am like you, Ezekiel Abaddon.
The collar beating in Abaddon's blood lit to rage.
I am...
On Istvan were the warriors that you slew not of your blood. Had they not bled with you, had they not shared bread and oaths and deeds at your side and you at theirs?
Abaddon saw the ruins again, the smoke coiling into the sky, the ash blowing on the dead wind.
Betrayer,
Logan had said. Abaddon tasted the words of his reply, still bitter even in memory.
There was nothing to betray.
Layak inclined his head towards the blade slaves.
I put swords into my brother's hands. You sheathed your sword in the hearts of those who had trusted you and thought the bonds between you unbreakable.
Abaddon could not move. In his mind, the images of the past rolled over and over. The things done, the wars fought, murder, slaughter, and deception.
There was nothing to betray, he said. They were not my brothers.
Because they made a different choice.
Because loyalty is everything.
And as he spoke the words, he heard the old truth that he had carried in him since he had been a boy, standing in a cave looking at a knife that would kill his companions and make him a king.
We were brothers and sons.
And that mattered more than oaths to an imperium? More than duty or truth?
You can't be loyal to an idea, priest, as your kind learned in the ashes of your first belief.
A strange dry rattle came from behind the teeth of Layak's mask. After a second, Abaddon realized that the priest was laughing.
Belief is all that we have left, and loyalty to an idea is why I am here.
Chaos,
said Abaddon, his lips peeling back from his teeth.
No,
said Layak with a shake of his head.
The truth?
Abaddon felt another question form in his mind, but cut it away and turned back to the bridge displays. The ships of the Word-Bearers and Thousand Suns within the fleet were already aligning, forming their own formation within the greater mass of Abaddon's armada, a subtle blade hidden amongst many. The vessels of this third force were few in number, a dozen only, but that was as it needed to be. Their part in the greater plan required them to go unseen, while the eyes of the defenders of Sol were elsewhere. Within an hour, the bulk of Abaddon's armada would turn and begin the next stage of their descent towards the inner system. The Thousand Suns and the Word-Bearers would carry on, though, cutting their engines so that they fell away silent and dark, down and down into the gulf between the turning planets. Only once they were closer to their goal would they relight their engines. Sorcery would wrap them, pulling eyes and minds away from them until their task was done.
The sorcerers of Prospero and the warriors of my legion will do what is ordained, said Layak,
as though following Abaddon's thoughts.
But my path lies with you, Ezekiel Abaddon, and I will follow it. That is my choice and my place. Kill me if you must, but I will remain.
Abaddon watched the dance of the void without replying, and when he looked around, The priest was gone. Warship Lance of Heaven, Suprasolar Gulf. Jubal Khan listened to the last ghosts of voices fade into the crackle of the Voxlink. He looked at the tech adept linked to the signal unit.
"Send confirmation," he said.
The adept bowed its head with a whir of gears, and the constellations of lights on the unit began to blink. It would take over 2 hours for the reply to reach Terra, if it reached it at all. Distortion had been growing on the signal channels for days, squalling like a snagged storm wind. Sometimes it seemed as though there were voices, high and pained, drowning in the screech of interference, shouting from beyond the buzz of static. No, thought Jubal. There were voices behind there, and he knew enough to know that the nightmares that racked the astropaths were real too. Both were echoes of the dead, returning to the plane of the living, but whether they spoke warnings or lies, he could not tell. He turned slowly away from the Vox console. His body ached at the movement. It was as though every year of the life that he had lived was dragging on his bones. He would need to settle his spirit before they rode into the fire again. The storm was coming. He could hear it. He could feel it. Changshi waited dutifully behind him, watching his Khan with grey eyes that could not hide their worry. Changshi was a child of the storm. Like the rest of the Token Force and the Lance of Heaven, he was not of Trigoris, despite the name he bore. It, like the organs grafted into him, were a gift of his elevation from the forgotten ocean world he had been born on. There were many like him now, creations of necessity, made from and for these bitter times, warriors who had never known the joy that came from waging war for a reason other than survival. Both his nature and name had barely had time to settle into his being, and whether fate would give Changshi the time to become the warrior he could one day be, Jubal did not know.
"So we withdraw?" Changshi asked, frowning.
Jubal looked at him, holding the young warrior's gaze for a long moment, and then smiling.
"Yes and no," he said, pulling a strip of parchment from his belt and handing it to Changshi. "Prepare signals to these of our ships, and see that these preparations are made throughout the Lance."
The young warrior read the Trigorian script, and his frown deepened.
"Master, I do not..."
"We have a duty to perform before we follow our orders. This spear-tip fleet is almost in the core of the system. We have tracked it, and we have bled it. But it will still strike like a bolt of thunder."
Jubal paused for a second, weighing his decision for a final time.
"We must take the heart of its strength before then."
"Master, 5,000 ships. We cannot destroy that many, even if we harried them for 10,000 years.
"I said we needed to take the heart of its strength. And that is not a ship. It is a man. A warrior, like you and me. Great and terrible and weak and vulnerable, as we all are."
And then he told the young warrior what would happen. At the end, Changshi bowed his head, but his face was grim.
"What weighs on you?" asked Jubal.
"You said we had a duty. But how can we have a duty that drives against our orders?"
Jubal laughed and let the sound drain away slowly.
"Which matters more, to obey the word or to obey the spirit?"
Changshi held his gaze still.
"When the words are the Great Khan's and Primarch Dawn's, is there a difference?"
"Always," replied Jubal. "Words are the weak children of the will and the soul. To see them truly, we must look through them and ask what spirit moved to make those words."
He reached down to his belt, drew his knife, tossed it up in the air, caught it by the blade and threw it to Changshi. The young warrior caught it. The blade was the length of a mortal human's forearm, curved like the moon, polished to a mirror sheen. Opals gleamed on its pommel.
"Put it in my heart," Jubal said.
Changshi looked at him sharply. Jubal grinned.
"Or at least try to," he said.
Changxi was still for a second, and then turned, his weight dropping, the curved blade vanishing behind his body. His eyes had gone distant, fixed on nothing, but seeing everything. Jubal waited, relaxed, his hands at his sides, smile still in place. Changxi nodded to himself as if deciding, then paused and opened his mouth to ask a question. He snapped forwards.
Wind of truth, but the boy was fast, thought Jubal.
The cover for the strike had been good, too, combining timing and subtle misdirection. But he was Jubal Khan, and he had faced and bested many of the greatest weapon masters of the age. He half-turned his torso, let the blade go past, brought his hand up, clamped Changxi's knife hand and wrist, and threw him with a sharp twist. The young warrior came to his feet in a blur. Jubal tapped the flat of the knife on Changxi's head as he rose.
"Not quite," he said.
Changxi closed his eyes, and Jubal could almost hear the silent self-chastisement held behind the warrior's teeth.
"You know the truth of death?" Jubal asked.
Changxi let out a breath and smiled.
"To embrace it like a brother, and laugh in its face."
"Yes," grinned Jubal. "And the truth of the knife?"
"To be sharp,"
Jubal chuckled.
"Yes, but no."
He stepped away, turned, rolled his shoulders.
"To put a knife through someone's heart is the end. It is not the means."
He could almost see the question forming on Changxi's lips, could hear the inhalation of breath before the words. Jubal spun and slashed with the knife. Changxi blocked the first blow, fast, very fast, but Jubal had already reversed the knife, hooked the warrior's arm with it and yanked his guard aside. Changxi recovered, but Jubal flicked the knife between his hands, slammed a palm into the young warrior's breastplate to rock him back, cut, switched hands again before the first cut had been blocked, then pivoted back out of range of Changxi. The young warrior made to follow, but Jubal raised a hand.
"Look,"
he said, pointing at Changxi's armour with the point of his knife. The young warrior looked. Long, straight cut marks scored the plate just above both of Changxi's wrists and elbows.
"And with the next clash, another cut," said Jubal, stepping close to Changxi and tapping the tip of the blade against the young warrior's upper arm, against his fingers. "And with each cut, a little more strength bleeds away. A little more rage is planted in the heart. A little more blindness in the eye. Until..."
He tapped the knife against Changxi's breastplate, above the heart.
"Until the blow to the heart is not seen and cannot be stopped," said Changxi.
Jubal nodded and flicked the knife over and held it out to the young warrior, pommel first.
"That is the truth of the knife. Of life, of war. You kill with the last blow, but those cuts that come before allow that final blow to fall. Even Horus, master of the spear thrust, knew that truth once. And now we will use it to kill whichever of his sons he has sent at the head of this armada."
Changxi took the knife, looking at it, the reflection of the crescent blade caught in his grey eyes. It was a beautiful weapon, made on Chagoris and fitted with a power field generator by the Legion Smiths. It had been Jubal's father's, given to him when he left his family and his humanity behind. Now the young warrior, who bore a Chagorian name but had never seen its skies, looked at it, and realization formed in his eyes.
"Master, I cannot accept this."
"You can and you will. Just as you will go from my side and join the blade of the endless horizon before the strike. But you shall bear that knife and its truth as this battle spirals down into the throat of the sun and beyond."
He paused.
"Someone must ride beyond the horizon."
The young warrior nodded, and Jubal began to turn away.
"You said that Horus knows the truth of knives in war," began Changxi.
Jubal turned back to look at the young warrior, feeling a frown form on his face.
then might we not be fighting the cuts and not seeing the thrust to our heart?
Jubal blinked and then smiled.
Yes, he said. But we fight anyway.